peers, broadsides with your favorite bathrooms peer, me. Stay tuned. We're going to be reviewing the City Council's elimination of the right to vote on the referendum to impeach Bush, which it did the last council, as well as other council actions. And if I can find it, the Public Safety Committee's elimination of your and our right to review the surveillance non-guidelines with which the police department now operates under. Stay tuned. And that was Grito Serpentino with its Trece Cholos. I call it Downtown because it's all about downtown. Sounds like downtown San Jose. Anyway, you're tuned to Free Radio. As I mentioned before, this is 101.1 also freakradio.org. Also, you can go to pagesandcolor.com for an occasional chat room chat, which hasn't been chatting much the last month, actually. Or you can call in. The call-in number is easy to remember. It's 427-FRSC, and that's because we're Free Radio Santa Cruz. So you have alternatives in case you want to get in touch, and the more you contact us, the more you speak up, the greater diversity of voices we have on this station, and the more chance you have to have your voice heard, which is what it's all about. And hopefully you'll avail yourself of that opportunity. And that's, again, 427-3772, 427-FRSC. So I'm going to begin this show. I mentioned we're going to be reviewing City Council's antics and obstructions to the democratic process while pretending, of course, to be effectuating the democratic process at the last council meeting of the summer 2 days ago. Before we do, however, I'm going to finish an interview that I was playing at the end of the Sunday show. You can catch the show on Sunday, 9:30 to 1 o'clock in the afternoon. And that was from a guy I call Midnight John, who actually apparently works at Denny's, and he's willing to risk his job by talking about life at Denny's, which is an all-night restaurant, which, of course, has a number of folks coming in out of the cold, nurse a cup of coffee or grab a bite to eat or sort of hang out as long as they can. And he talks about the situation there. If you want to view or actually listen to the show, you can go back. It should be archived now on the Huff website. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom, H-U-F-F. And it's at www.huffsantacruz, all one word, all small letters, huffsantacruz.com. Just check it out. It's under the name of our show, which again is Bathrobes, Pierres, Broadsides. And check the date. Anyway, this is the second part of that interview. And then we're going to be going on to a couple of things, including I'm going to finish up with the Reefer Madness discussion of it's Eric Schlosser's audio reading of his own book on, the subtitle of the book is called Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. So we got a lot of stuff coming up, so stay with me. And call in if you got any comments or thoughts.
So you actually have fed the poor people coming into Denny's?
Oh, yeah, as much as I can. Like, it's definitely a place where you find people of all types at some moments that they're really, really down on their luck. It's kind of a light to a bunch of moths in this place, because it's the only place that's open and recognizable in the middle of the night.
Santa Cruz Diner.
Yeah, they kick everybody out there, as far as I can tell.
So you think Denny's has a more liberal policy than the diner?
No, I think I have a more liberal policy. I don't think Denny's has a more liberal policy than the diner at all.
I actually been arrested at Denny's twice.
No. When did you get arrested today?
It was a while ago. It was 17 years ago. I was arrested because they wouldn't serve a homeless person, so we sat there and took a bus for the homeless person, and they dropped all the charges and actually negotiated letting the homeless person eat there. So we won our victory. We should have sued them, however, and then we would have really won our victory.
Was it
5
in the morning?
It was in the evening. Or in the afternoon. It was a standard deal. They'd refused to serve a woman named Barbara Hagland. That was her name. And so six of us came and sat in the counter, and they demanded she leave, and then we said we were with her, and then they demanded we leave, and said, we've already got coffee, we've ordered, ready to pay, you know. You can, we're calling the police. Well, you can call the FBI too, you know, it'll be okay. And they did, so.
Yeah, well, I've also seen people get arrested there. I've seen the police have chased people into there. In fact, the last interaction I had with the police was an officer that walked in and asked me the very specific question, have you seen two people, one man, one a woman?
Well, that seems general.
Yes, I wondered if there was anything more to the story than that. He said, well, they'd be together.
Ah, narrowing the field.
Yes, of course. And told them, unfortunately, it happened at that moment. There was nothing but men in the restaurant completely. So I said, but sorry, I haven't seen any women at all tonight. And he left dejectedly.
Oh, well, you know, you can't please every police officer every time he comes in. Any What's the story? Do you feel homeless people who eat there, do they usually nurse a cup of coffee for an hour and a half, or what happens?
Well, it usually depends on what their plan is for the night. A lot of the times people are meeting each other there. It's kind of a central place. Like, if people have the money for a cup of coffee, then they will stay there all night and nurse it if they can. And I try to let everybody sleep. My only rule for being there, basically, is that you have to treat everyone with the same respect that I treat people. And that,
well, these homeless people stink. They're dirty and they have ugly clothing. So what do you do about that?
Well, if people really stink badly, I'll usually put them in an isolated section of the restaurant just out of respect for the rest of my customers, and because otherwise I don't make any tips then, and I can't help anybody then. But
what about homeless people using the bathroom to shower and clean up and otherwise engage in questionable hygienic activity?
I don't know what you're talking about. I don't see anything of the sort, ever.
How does this compare with Baker's Square?
Well, Baker's Square wasn't really open during the middle of the night, so they had a much less leniency towards the homeless population using the facilities. Denny's as a whole, as a corporation, allows anyone to use their restrooms at any time. So unless people have been in there for, you know, a half an hour, like I've had people sleeping in there, I've had people smoking in the bathroom.
Shooting up crack, perhaps?
Not crack.
Or smoking.
Probably. I don't know. I don't really go and check on anybody. Hmm. That's the thing. So I usually let...
No check for track marks?
No.
No weapon searches?
No weapon searches.
Naive boy, you.
I've never had a single fight between homeless people when I've worked there and all my time working there. The only fights I've ever seen are exclusively between middle-aged white people, white men that are out with their friends.
Wow. What about you? You have some connection with this man. What is your name, madam?
My name's Jolie.
And Jolie, you see this man when he comes home after a hard night's work?
I guess, unless I'm asleep, yeah.
Has he ever told you any tales that perhaps he hasn't confided in us that we should know about?
I don't know. I know about a lot of people coming in there after they get out of jail and being in the unfortunate situations they're in. They don't have any money, or they've been in the drunk tank all night and they've gotten, what's the word, let out without their IDs sometimes, and without the money they went in there with, possibly, and without a place to go because they are either still drunk or were homeless previously to that, who knows. And I know that some of the employees definitely there do their share of letting people stay there, and there are definitely some that don't let people hang out at Denny's more when the morning shift, when the sun comes up after he gets off. But the graveyard shift, I would say, is pretty chill.
Cool. Has Denny's become more yuppie? Any comments from either of you on this?
Denny's serves such a general swath of the population that, like, I hate to break it down into labels like that. It's really just really much more of a who's up rather than like a certain class of people or a certain type of people.
A lot of police officers eat in Denny's?
No, actually, the police don't usually eat in Denny's because they don't like to have to work. And if they sit around in Denny's long enough, they usually see something that they feel they have to do something about. So,
Seen that happen? You've seen a police officer looking longingly at a poor homeless person and then finally can't control himself any longer, leaps up and issues a citation?
No. Most of the police aren't there for very long. We try the police usually, if the police start pulling people over in front of the restaurant or if the police are in there, one of the people working there will ask if you can pull someone over somewhere else because they drive off all the business. And nobody stops when there's police parked out front pulling people over.
You mean, are you suggesting that local citizenry don't support our valiant police officers' attempt to rein in the homeless crime wave?
Why, yes, that's exactly what I'd be suggesting.
Did you have a comment?
Well, I was just saying, I remember a story about a girl calling her father, the officer, to get rid of a homeless person from Denny's sometime back. Isn't that true? You remember that?
Yeah, a girl that was about 19... called her father, who was a police officer, to come and have removed from the restaurant. And I was on break when this happened, unfortunately. And when I got back, the guy who I'd been serving coffee and serving a meal to was gone, as well as this young woman who did not like the smell and the look of this homeless person that was sitting next to her. So she called up Dad and had Dad come down and take care of it for her.
Filial loyalty, I suppose. It's a touching thing when it happens in these circumstances. I'm running out of questions, but actually, you know, you're quite a source of information. Maybe we need to take your number and call you later.
All right. My number is...
Yeah, and of course, there are new musical events all over town, and I mean on the street musical events. So, for instance, down here, and right adjacent to a city parking lot near the Hair Gallery, near Pearl Alley, we have some drummers and a guitarist. I should say one drummer, one guitarist, and one woman on the violin are performing on the sidewalk.
So far only one. So far.
The name of this group?
Unconditional Love Machine.
Cool. Thank you.
All mine.
And there is also, of course, a musical event that goes on at the Farmer's Market, or next to it, every Wednesday between 4 and 7, or I guess will until Crow's permit runs out every week. And that event is a lot of music, which is accompanied by food distribution from Food Not Bombs.
And now, the concluding portion of the central section of Eric Schlosser's Reefer Madness book. This is a section about immigrants and the exploitation of migrant labor, which is really close to home. And for activists, is kind of an inspiring thing because of the mass turnout, the mass rising up of people that happened May 1st here in Santa Cruz, probably the biggest protest in a decade. Or, well, at least since the February March Against the War in 2003, which had 3,000 to 6,000 people. I guess police estimated 7,000 back then, interestingly enough. But this had thousands and thousands of people at the town clock. And last time I played a bit of Eric Schlosser's book, which talks about the situation of people, well, not just strawberry pickers, but fruit pickers of all kinds and their living conditions and the way this historically was kind of dropping away, but then the destruction of the state failure to support unionization and the Cesar Chavez's movement in spite of, you know, nice little holidays that have been declared and the shrinkage of the United Farm Workers and other labor groups and other protections for farm workers has resulted in, instead of mechanizing the strawberry trade and the other trades involving picking fruits, they have found it cheaper to simply send out the call for people, you know, who are over the border and get them to come over and work under the most wretched conditions. Of course, it provokes massive controversy here about what to do about this continual influx of labor, which isn't protected by unions, and they're afraid to organize themselves because they're deportable, criminalizable, and so forth. It's a very interesting and very, very pressing problem, which hasn't been much in the papers recently, although I guess the immigration controversy is coming back to Congress as the Republicans try to beat the drums for, I don't know, felony prosecutions of all people with illegal papers, which would mean millions of prosecutions and deportations, as well as guard dogs, barbed wire, and a wall all along the Mexican border, all this crazy talk. I myself am conflicted in terms of how to deal with immigrant labor because I don't, you know, there obviously should be, if you continue to allow businesses to advertise and to hire people at shit wages, with miserable accommodations, and they can simply, with no protections whatsoever, you're going to keep wages down and conditions bad. I don't know what the answer to this is. Anyway, here's some thoughts from Eric Schlosser of Reefer Madness. Again, if you want to hear the earlier part of this tape, check out the, I guess it was Sunday. It's either this Sunday or the Sunday, this last Sunday or the Sunday before, or you can go to the library and check out the tape or check out his book, Reefer Madness. Again, we're not talking about reefers here. We're talking about the black market labor, which is another aspect, just as the growth of marijuana and the sales is an aspect of the black market.
Locked into dependence. The immigration history of Guadalupe, California, can be read in the names and faces adorning headstones at its small cemetery. The Swiss and Italian and Portuguese surnames belong to families who settled in the Santa Maria Valley around the turn of the last century, growing beans and sugar beets, running cattle, and raising dairy herds. The Chinese, Japanese, and Filipino names belong to the first wave of farm workers, some of whom managed to acquire land of their own. Spanish surnames greatly outnumber the rest, marking the recent graves along with plastic flowers and the images of saints. There is a sepulchral custom in Guadalupe, practiced for generations. Most of the headstones bear sepia-tinted photographs of the deceased. Walking through the graveyard, one sees at a glance the slightly different ethnic traits and subtle variations in skin color, long the basis of economic status and rivalry. Now all these faces stare in the same direction from the same place, arranged like crops in long straight rows. For most of the 20th century, the Santa Maria Valley had a diverse farm economy. Although migrants were a large seasonal presence, the area lacked the huge industrial farms that dominated the landscape elsewhere in California. The acreage around Guadalupe was devoted primarily to field crops and irrigated pasture. The cattle ranches and dairy farms were owned and managed by local families. Fruits and vegetables, though an important source of revenue, occupied a small portion of the agricultural land. Then, from the early 1970s to the late 1980s, the Santa Maria Valley was transformed. As field crops and dairy products became less profitable, farmers either switched to high-value specialty crops or quit farming. Much of the land was bought by outside corporations, such as Mobil and the Bank of America. Irrigated pastures became strawberry fields, dotted with oil wells, on leased land. The number of migrant workers soared. In 1960, Guadalupe's population was 18% Latino. Today, it is about 85% Latino. The middle classes fled to the nearby city of Santa Maria, leaving behind a rural underclass. Juan Vicente Palerm has spent the last two decades studying the social and economic changes in the Santa Maria Valley. The director of the University of California's Institute for Mexico in the United States, Palerm is an anthropologist by training. His early field work traced the lives of Spanish guest workers in Northern Europe, migrants imported by treaty to labor in factories and fields. He is an imposing figure, with a graying beard of a patriarch, and has a remarkable grasp not only of labor market dynamics, but also of how every crop in the valley is planted, tended, marketed, and sold. I spent a day with Palerm and one of his graduate students, Manolo Gonzalez, who picked strawberries for a year as part of his research. Driving the side streets of Guadalupe, touring the fields, and discussing how the growers of California and the peasants of rural Mexico created an agricultural system that has locked them into mutual dependence. By relying on poor migrants from Mexico, California growers established a wage structure that discouraged American citizens from seeking farm work. The wages offered at harvest were too low to sustain a family in the United States, but they were up to 10 times as high as any wages Mexican peasants could earn in their native villages. A system evolved in which the cheap labor of Mexican migrants subsidized California agriculture, while remittances from that farm work preserved rural communities in Mexico that otherwise might have collapsed. For decades, the men of Mexican villages have traveled north to the fields of California, leaving behind women, children, and the elderly to look after their small farms. Migrant work in California has long absorbed Mexican surplus labor, while Mexico has, in effect, paid for the education, health care, and retirement of California's farm workers. Whenever migrants decided to settle in California, however, they disrupted the smooth workings of this system by imposing higher costs on the state, especially if they married and raised children. That is why the Immigration and Naturalization Service, INS, used to round up and deport illegal immigrants in California immediately after the harvest. Nevertheless, millions of Mexican farm workers have settled in the United States over the years, most of them becoming American citizens. Although agricultural employment has long been a means of entering U.S. society, low wages and poor working conditions have made it an occupation that most immigrants and their children hope to escape. Farm labor is more physically demanding and less financially rewarding than almost any other kind of work. A migrant who finds a job in a factory can triple his or her income. As a result, the whole system now depends upon a steady supply of illegal immigrants to keep farm wages low and to replace migrants who have either retired to Mexico or found better jobs in California. Juan Vicente Palerm believes that today there are not only more migrants shuttling back and forth from Mexico, but also more Mexican farm workers settling permanently in California. Throughout the state, towns like Guadalupe, Calexico, Cutler, and McFarland are becoming enclaves of rural poverty. In the Santa Maria Valley, the increased production of fruits and vegetables, higher yields per acre, and an extended growing season have created thousands of full and part-time jobs for farm workers. Broccoli fields now occupy more than 20,000 acres, requiring a large supply of resident workers for a staggered harvest that lasts most of the year. Celery and cauliflower production has also increased the number of full-time jobs. Perhaps 40% of the farm labor in the valley is currently performed by workers who live there. Many farm workers now own houses, but the strawberry fields have drawn thousands of poor migrants to the area. Only 12% of the workforce at a strawberry farm can claim year-round employment, and cultivating the fruit is so labor-intensive, 25 times as labor-intensive as cultivating broccoli, that strawberry production now employs more farm workers than the production of all the vegetables grown in the valley combined. Most strawberry pickers hope to find jobs in the neighboring vegetable fields, where the wages are better and the work is less arduous. Turnover rates are extremely high in the strawberry workforce. But there is no impending shortage of potential migrants. The rural population of Mexico has tripled since the 1940s. In terms of absolute numbers, Palerm says, there are far more Mexican peasants today than ever before. 25 years ago, academic texts declared that California agriculture, with its large-scale irrigation, sophisticated farming practices, corporate structure, and low-wage imported labor, was unique. That is no longer true. Southern Spain is fast becoming the California of Europe, borrowing many of the same techniques to grow the same high-value crops and relying on illegal immigrants from North Africa. Southern Italy and Mediterranean France are adopting the system as well. Mexico, Guatemala, and Chile, with the aid of foreign investors, are recreating California's industrial agriculture in Latin America, producing some crops that now compete with those grown in the United States. Improvements in transportation systems and cooling technology have created an international market for commodities that until recent years were rarely exported. Juan Vicente Palerm believes that the cultivation of fruits and vegetables for processing will increasingly shift from California to Mexico, where labor costs are much lower. Mexico will produce the frozen vegetables for TV dinners, while California grows artichokes, broccoli, strawberries, and asparagus for the fresh market. The harvest of these specialty crops, however, cannot easily be mechanized. Their high value is closely linked to their unblemished appearance. The prosperity of California agriculture increasingly depends on uninterrupted access to Mexico's peasantry. Most of the strawberry workers in the Santa Maria Valley are Mixtec Indians, some of the poorest and most exploited people in the Western Hemisphere. Soil erosion and declining crop yields in the mountains of western Oaxaca have forced the Mixtecs to become migrant workers. According to Michael Carney, a professor of anthropology at the University of California at Riverside, their choice is simple: migrate or starve. Mixtecs now dominate the lowest paid jobs in California agriculture. In Tijuana, you often see the wives and children of Mixtec farm workers, small and dark and beautiful, dressed in the bright colors of their native villages, selling chiclets to tourists on the street. Until the 1970s, almost all the Mexican farm workers in California were mestizos, with strong links to communities already in the state. The new migrants present social workers with unusual challenges. In addition to the 92 dialects of Mixtec, there are at least half a dozen other pre-Columbian languages spoken by the indigenous peoples of Oaxaca. Perhaps one-fifth of the Mixtec farm workers in California speak little English or Spanish. Throughout their migratory route, Mixtecs are the victims of robbery and discrimination. In central Mexico, they must run a gauntlet of officials demanding bribes. In Tijuana, they are preyed upon by smugglers, rapists, and thieves. In the Imperial Desert, east of San Diego, they risk their lives crossing the border. Two or three migrants now die there from exposure every week. In Guadalupe, many of the settled farm workers resent the new arrivals from Oaxaca. Illegal immigrants often crossed picket lines during the 1980s, helping to drive the UFW from the valley. Adjusted for inflation, the hourly wages have declined, and there is widespread underemployment. Labor contractors now actively recruit illegals, who work for less money and raise fewer objections than legal residents. At harvest time, Guadalupe's population of roughly 5,700 swells by as much as one-third, placing great demands on local services. Palermo's researchers once discovered 22 people living in a two-bedroom apartment. Despite the hardships of the long journey, Mixtecs hoping to sustain their native villages have a strong incentive to find work in California. Wages in Oaxaca are about $2 or $3 a day. Wages in the strawberry fields of Baja California are about $5 a day. A Mixtec farm worker in the Santa Maria Valley, making $10 an hour at the peak of the strawberry harvest, can earn more in one day than he or she could earn back home in a month. A reliance on misfortune. In 1951, the President's Commission on Migratory Labor condemned the abysmal living conditions of illegal immigrants employed as migrant workers in the United States. At the time, workers were found living in orchards and irrigation ditches. They lived in constant fear of apprehension, like fugitives, and were routinely exploited by their employers, who could maintain unsafe working conditions, cut wages, or abruptly dismiss them with little worry of reprisal. In many cases, the life of these migrants was, according to the commission, virtually peonage. The commission estimated that 40% of the migrants in the United States, at least 400,000 people, were illegal immigrants. Their presence in such large numbers depressed wages for all farm workers. That fact was unquestionable. Indeed, illegal immigrants had begun to displace native-born workers, not only in agriculture, but in non-farm occupations, such as construction. The commission argued that the only way to stop the flow of illegals was to impose harsh punishments on growers who employed and exploited them. It suggested fines, imprisonment, and a strict prohibition on the shipment and interstate commerce of any goods harvested by illegal immigrants. We depend on misfortune to build up our force of migratory workers, the commission concluded, and when the supply is low because there is not enough misfortune at home, we rely on misfortune abroad to replenish the supply. Congress ignored the commission's recommendations, and for the next two decades it was a crime to be an illegal immigrant in the United States, but not a crime to employ one. In 1986, Congress passed the Immigration Reform and Control Act, IRCA, which demanded broad sanctions against the employers of illegal immigrants. But these sanctions have rarely been applied. There are about 1 million private employers in California, and about 200 federal inspectors to investigate workplace violations of the immigration code. Moreover, the federal penalties for employing an illegal immigrant are rather mild. A first offense may result in a fine of $250, a third offense in a fine of $3,000. Instead of stemming illegal immigration, IRCA actually encouraged it. In response to growers' fears that the new sanctions on employers would create a shortage of farm workers, Congress included in the bill a special amnesty for illegal immigrants who could prove they had done farm work in the previous year. It did not demand much proof. Backed by Congressman Leon Panetta and Senator Pete Wilson, both from California, the Special Agricultural Worker Program, SAW, was expected to grant legal status to 350,000 illegal immigrants. Instead, almost 1.3 million illegal immigrants, a number roughly equivalent at the time to 1/6 of the adult male population of rural Mexico, applied for this amnesty, most of them using phony documents in what has been called one of the greatest immigration frauds in American history. More than 1 million illegal immigrants were eventually granted legal status. Many were soon joined illegally by their wives and children. Instead of shrinking the farm labor force, IRCA guaranteed an oversupply of workers. Counterfeit green cards, social security cards, driver's licenses, and SAW work histories, the documents necessary to obtain employment as a farm worker, can be easily obtained in rural California for $50. The process usually takes about an hour. At the moment, an estimated 7 to 8 million illegal immigrants live in the United States. About half of them are Mexican. While some advocates of immigration reform call for another large amnesty, granting green cards or full citizenship to millions, California growers prefer a new guest worker program. It would recruit migrant workers through an international agreement and would guarantee their wages, their living conditions, and their return to Mexico at the end of the harvest. Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, also advocates the creation of a formal, well-regulated program to ensure the orderly flow of migrants between the two countries. The United States government operated a similar endeavor called the Bracero Program from 1942 to 1964. Migrants who enrolled in the program were shuttled to huge holding pens at the border, forced to await employment with numbers hung around their necks, and then stripped naked and sprayed with a delousing agent before being allowed to enter the United States. Once in this country, the braceros were all but powerless and were bound to a single employer. The Bracero program was terminated amid revelations that its guest workers were widely being abused. Historians now agree that the program established the social networks and migratory patterns responsible for the subsequent waves of illegal immigration. Indeed, during the program's existence, there were often more illegal immigrants than braceros employed in American agriculture. Despite all these facts, Juan Vicente Palerm does not rule out lending his support to a new guest worker program. He has no illusions about such arrangements, having witnessed their implementation in Western Europe during the 1960s, their successes, and ultimate failure. His willingness to consider a guest worker program today is based on pragmatism. The living conditions of migrants in California have become so bad and the dangers they now face crossing the border are so severe that Palerm feels something must be done at once. A guest worker program, while no solution, is at least a first step. The North American Free Trade Agreement permits the free movement of American capital across borders without offering any legal protection to Mexican migrant workers. Palerm believes that the terms of a guest worker program could guarantee migrants some of the basic rights they do not enjoy today. Even if illegal immigration continued alongside the officially approved migration, those farm workers in the program would no longer have to live underground. Opponents of guest worker programs have long based their objections on principle. More than two decades ago, Sidney Weintraub and Stanley R. Ross, then at the University of Texas, suggested that guest worker is simply a modern euphemism for an indentured laborer. A guest worker program legally embraces the concept of second-class citizenship in the United States. It creates a group of people who have limited rights. Aside from the philosophical objections that can be raised, many argue that such programs just don't work. There's nothing more permanent, one economist has said, than temporary workers. Guest worker programs were discontinued in Europe because large numbers of Algerian, Moroccan, and Turkish workers chose to settle instead of returning home. Mexican farm workers have long dominated the agricultural labor force in California and the Southwest, but only recently have they begun to migrate throughout the United States. Mexican farm workers, many of them illegal immigrants, are now picking raspberries in Oregon, detasseling corn in Iowa, harvesting tobacco in Virginia, and tending plants in New Jersey nurseries. Moreover, the same methods long used to employ illegal immigrants in California agriculture, the reliance on intermediaries such as labor contractors, are being used to employ them in the meatpacking industry, construction work, janitorial service, and the garment industry. The majority of illegal immigrants in California now work in non-farm occupations and come from regions throughout Mexico, including urban areas such as Mexico City. Michael Carney thinks that the indigenous people of Chiapas will soon join Mixtecs in the migratory stream. Farm worker organizers strongly oppose a new guest worker program, while others ask why the government should serve as a labor contractor for agricultural interests. Non-farm industries are just as eager to hire low-wage workers. Hotels, motels, fast food restaurants, and meatpacking plants would also like to employ guest workers. Such a recruitment program is unnecessary, opponents say, when so many poor Mexican farm workers already in the United States are struggling to find work. Philip L. Martin, who served for 4 years as a member of the Commission on Agricultural Labor, a group mandated by IRCA, believes that the most effective way to improve the lives of farm workers is simply to enforce the existing labor and immigration laws. Lax federal enforcement has amounted to a tremendous subsidy for fruit and vegetable growers, one that has distorted the economics of these industries. Cheap labor benefits agriculture in the short run, Martin argues, but it also helps to blind farmers to the technological changes they will have to make in order to compete with foreign producers who have access to even cheaper labor. As long as the United States tolerates the employment of illegal immigrants in agriculture, Martin believes, the farm labor market will continue the endless cycle in which farm workers quit for better jobs and illegals arrive to replace them. We have essentially privatized the immigration policy of this country, Martin says, and left it in the hands of California's growers. Joaquin Avila, a former president of the Mexican-American Legal Defense and Educational Fund, thinks the distinction between legal and illegal farm workers is less important at this point than the level of wages being paid. The labor market interdependence between the United States and Mexico, a relationship that evolved over decades, cannot be severed overnight. Until economic development in Mexico has diminished the underlying need for migration, he says, the emphasis in the United States should be on making sure that all workers, regardless of their nationality, are paid a decent wage and protected from exploitation. Despite the many policy options regarding farm workers, the most likely scenario is that, at the federal level, nothing will be done. The plight of migrants has been deplored by presidential commissions and congressional subcommittees for more than a century, and yet little has fundamentally changed. Growers still exert a great deal of political influence, while farm workers possess virtually none. Except for a flurry of attention every few decades, the American people have greeted the whole subject with indifference. The nation's fresh produce is less expensive as a result, but not much. Maintaining the current level of poverty among migrant farm workers saves the average American household about $50 a year. During the spring of 1996, the UFW began a major organizing campaign in California's strawberry fields, backed by millions of dollars from the AFL-CIO. A march through Watsonville attracted 12,000 supporters. The strawberry campaign's slogan was, 5 cents for fairness. If the growers added just a nickel to the price of every pint of strawberries, the UFW argued, and gave that extra nickel to their workers, migrant wages would rise by as much as 50%. Growers did not jump at the idea. The previous year, when workers at a strawberry farm in Ventura County overwhelmingly voted to join the UFW, the grower responded by plowing under part of the field immediately and then shutting down the entire operation at the end of the season. The workers were fired and had to sue for back wages. In response to the UFW strawberry campaign, which received nationwide publicity, growers took a more subtle approach. They hired the Dolphin Group, a Los Angeles public relations firm, to present a kinder, gentler view of the industry. The Dolphin Group had for years worked closely with right-wing Republican candidates and causes. It had produced the infamous Willie Horton ad that helped sink the presidential candidacy of Michael Dukakis. It had created a phony anti-smoking group, Californians for Statewide Smoking Restrictions, using money from Philip Morris and the tobacco industry. It had created a phony grape workers group, the Grape Workers and Farmers Coalition, using money from the California table grape industry. And so in 1996, it created the Strawberry Workers and Farmers Alliance, SW&FA, using money from the strawberry industry. The SW&FA staged its own march in Watsonville, earned the blessing of the local Catholic bishop, and called for farm workers' rights and human rights. It also claimed that female UFW organizers were seducing migrant workers to gain support for the union. Launched with high hopes, the UFW strawberry campaign was soon bogged down in disputes with front organizations backed by growers, such as the SW&FA, the Strawberry Pro-Workers Committee, and the Agricultural Workers Committee. Poor migrants who'd never belonged to any union were suddenly confronted by a series of groups claiming to have their best interests at heart. UFW organizers were attacked by anti-union thugs, and many workers feared that showing support for any union might get them fired. The economic benefits a union might bring had to be carefully weighed against the possibility of swiftly becoming unemployed. The UFW managed to win contracts at the state's largest organic strawberry farm and at farms owned by Coastal Berry, the state's largest strawberry grower. UFW workers at those farms gained a pay increase, seniority rights, leaves of absence, paid holidays, and medical insurance for their entire families. Although union organizing continues in the strawberry fields, the effort has proved to be difficult and disappointing. In September 2002, California's governor, Gray Davis, signed legislation that may strengthen the UFW. The two bills require official mediation whenever contract disputes with growers become stalled. At the moment, perhaps 1,600 of California's roughly 20,000 strawberry workers belong to the UFW. bowing down to the market. One morning in San Diego County, I met a strawberry grower named Doug. We sat and talked in a trailer on the edge of his field. Doug's father and his grandfather had both been sent to an internment camp for Japanese Americans during World War II. Upon their release, the grandfather bought a used truck. At first, he worked for other farmers, then he leased some land. He spoke no English, and so Doug's father, still a teenager, assumed an important role in the business. The two grew vegetables with success and eventually shifted to strawberries, shipping and processing the fruit as well. On the land where their original farm once stood, there are now condominiums, a park, and a school. Doug grows strawberries a few miles inland. His fields are surrounded by chain-link fences topped with barbed wire. An enormous real estate development, with hundreds of Spanish-style condo units, is creeping up the hills toward his farm. Many of the farmers nearby have already sold their land. Doug has spent most of his life in strawberry fields, learning every aspect of the business firsthand, but now isn't sure he wants his children to do the same. "Farming's not a glamorous business," Doug said. "Farmers don't have a high status in this community. In fact, we're resented by most people." With all the hassles today from the state and from his neighbors, he sometimes asks himself, "Hey, why do this?" Selling the land would make him instantly rich. Instead, he worries about water costs, about theft, about the strawberries from New Zealand he saw in the market the other day. Rain had wiped out a quarter of his early season berries, just when the market price was at its peak. Doug cannot understand the hostility toward growers in California. After all, agriculture preserves open land. He thinks Americans don't appreciate how lucky they are to have cheap food. He doesn't understand why anyone would impede strawberry production by limiting his access to migrants. "My workers are helping themselves," he said. "I've picked strawberries, and let me tell you, there is no harder work. I respect these people. They work damn hard. And my jobs are open to anyone who wants to apply." Every so often, college kids visit the ranch, convinced that picking strawberries would be a nice way to earn some extra money. Doug laughed. "They don't last an hour out here." We stepped from the trailer into bright sunshine. Workers move down the furrows under close supervision. Doug takes great pride in being a third-generation grower. He is smart, well-educated, meticulous, and it showed in his field. But I wondered if Doug and his workers would still be there in a few years. Doug picked a berry and handed it to me, a large Chandler that was brilliantly red. I took a bite. The strawberry was warm and sweet and fragrant, with a slightly bitter aftertaste from the soil. That evening, I inadvertently met some of Doug's workers. Ricardo Soto, a young lawyer at CRLA, had brought me to the edge of an avocado orchard to visit a hidden encampment of migrant workers. Perhaps one-third of the farm workers in northern San Diego County, about 7,000 people, are now homeless. An additional 9,000 of their family members are homeless, too. Many are living outdoors. The shortage of low-income housing became acute in the early 1980s, and large shanty towns began to appear, some containing hundreds of crude shacks. As suburbs encroached on agricultural land in northern San Diego County, wealthy commuters and strawberry pickers became neighbors. At one large shantytown I visited, women were doing their laundry in a stream, not far from a walled compound with tennis courts, a pool, and a sign promising country club living. The suburbanites do not like living beside Mexican farm workers. Instead of providing low-income housing, local authorities have declared states of emergency, passed laws to forbid curbside hiring, and bulldozed many of the large encampments. San Diego growers, appalled by the living conditions of their migrants, have tried to build farm worker housing near the fields, only to encounter fierce resistance from neighboring homeowners. Although the shanty towns lower nearby property values, permanent farm worker housing might reduce property values even more. When people find out you want to build housing for your migrants, one grower told me, they just go ballistic. The new encampments are smaller and built to avoid detection. At the end of a driveway, near a chain-link fence, I met a young Mixtec who lived in such an encampment. His name was Francisco, and he was 18 years old. He looked deeply exhausted. He had just picked strawberries for 12 hours at Doug's farm. I asked what he thought of Doug as a boss. "Not bad," he said politely. The previous year, Francisco had picked strawberries from April until July. He had saved $800 during that period and had wired all of it to his mother and father in the village of San Sebastian, Tecomaxtla, Oaxaca. This was Francisco's second season in the fields, but he had not seen much of San Diego County. He was too afraid of getting caught. His days were spent at the farm, his nights at the encampment. He picked strawberries 6 days a week, sometimes seven, for 10 or 12 hours a day. "When there's work," Francisco said, "you have to work." Each morning he woke up around 4:30 and walked for half an hour to reach Doug's field. At dusk, 13 tired men in dirty clothes approached us. They were all from Francisco's village. They worked together at Doug's farm and stayed at the same encampment. They knew one another's families back home and looked after one another here. The oldest was 43, and the youngest looked about 15. All the men were illegals. All were sick with coughs, but none dared to see a doctor. As the sun dropped behind the hills, clouds of mosquitoes descended, and yet the migrants seemed too tired to notice. They lay on their backs, on their sides, resting on the hard ground as though it were a sofa. Francisco offered to show me their encampment. We squeezed through a hole in the chain-link fence and through gaps in rusting barbed wire, and climbed a winding path enclosed by tall bushes. It felt like a medieval maze. As we neared the camp, I noticed beer cans and food wrappers littering the ground. We came upon the first shack, short and low, more like a tent, just silver trash bags draped over a wooden frame. A little farther up the path stood three more shacks in a small clearing. They were built of plywood and camouflaged. Branches and leaves had been piled on their roofs. The landowner did not know the migrants lived here, and the encampment would be difficult to find. These migrants were hiding out, like criminals or Viet Cong. Garbage was everywhere. Francisco pointed to his shack, which was about 5 feet high, 5 feet wide, and 7 feet long. He shared it with two other men. He had a good blanket. But when it rained at night, the roof leaked, and the men would go to work soaking wet the next day and dry off in the sun. Francisco had never lived this way before coming to San Diego. At home, he always slept in a bed. Beyond the sheds, bushes crowded the path again, and then it reached another clearing, where two battered lawn chairs had been placed at the edge of the hill. There was a wonderful view of strawberry fields, new houses, and the lights of the freeway in the distance. Driving back to my motel that night, I thought about the people of Orange County, one of the richest counties in the nation, big on family values, yet bankrupt from financial speculation, unwilling to raise taxes to pay for their own children's education, unwilling to pay off their debts, whining about the injustice of it, and blaming all their problems on illegal immigrants. And I thought about Francisco, their boogeyman, their scapegoat, working 10 hours a day at one of the hardest jobs imaginable, and sleeping on the ground every night for months so that he could save money and send it home to his parents. We have been told for years to bow down before the market. We have placed our faith in the laws of supply and demand. What has been forgotten or ignored is that the market rewards only efficiency. Every other human value gets in its way. The market will drive wages down like water until they reach the lowest possible level. Today that level is being set not in Washington or New York or Sacramento, but in the fields of Baja California and the mountain villages of Oaxaca. That level is about $5 a day. No deity that men have ever worshipped is more ruthless and more hollow than the free market unchecked. There is no reason why shanty towns should not appear on the outskirts of every American city. All those who now consider themselves devotees of the market should take a good look at what is happening in California. Left to its own devices, the free market always seeks a workforce that is hungry, desperate, and cheap. A workforce that is anything but free.
And that was Eric Schlosser reading his book, Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market, from a copy which is now overdue, and I'll be returning to the library tonight for all of you folks who want to run down there and grab it. You can also replay this, as I've mentioned before, by going to the Huff website, www.huffsantacruz, and you can hear portions played before on prior parts of this show. I apologize that I haven't indexed the shows, so you're going to have to kind of skim the net or surf through the shows to find the proper show. But I believe I played a part of this on Sunday, and I believe a part of it was played the prior Sunday. So you might check those two dates. Again, Eric Schlosser's Reefer Madness. The book is probably in the library. He wrote Fast Food Nation. And certainly opened my eyes to, it seems fact-rich, but of course I'm not an expert on the subject. I don't know how much of what he has to say is accurate, but it certainly gives me a whole new perspective on immigration and a lot more to think about and to talk about. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. I'm Robert Norris. This is Bathrop's Pierre's Broadsides. Show goes till 8 o'clock. And you can call in at any time to talk about what you've just heard or perhaps some other things that you've heard in the past or some things you haven't been hearing that you'd like to hear around the question of, essentially, we're talking about poverty in Santa Cruz City and County and civil rights for people who are outside or, quote, homeless and people who are near that condition and those of us who are losing rights in other ways. There's a play coming up at the Broadway Playhouse, I want to remind you of. It's been talked about by Free Radio Santa Cruz broadcaster Thomas Levitt on his Sunday show. It's called Can't Stop the Clock. And it's happening in an hour, 8 o'clock, 526 Broadway, tonight at San Francisco Art League, right across from the Resource Center for Inaction, or Nonviolence, as some call it. Some people are critical of the Resource Center because it's a... they think it's too pro-Palestinian. I'm critical of it because it doesn't take enough action on local issues that affect poor people here. But whatever it is, that's where you can go if you want to check out this production. It's at the Playhouse across from the Resource Center, up the road slightly, up Broadway, up the hill. I believe it's $8, but I think they have a sliding scale. So you can I think, probably negotiate your way in. There's only two performances of Can't Stop the Clock that I'm aware of. That's tonight at 8 o'clock, and then on Saturday night, July 29th, again at 8 o'clock. Again, that's 526 Broadway, near Ocean, Can't Stop the Clock, 8 o'clock tonight. So now's the time to hop on your bike or put on your shoes or jump in your gas guzzler and wander over that away. Maybe take the bus, although I'm not quite sure. Anyway, it's near Ocean and Broadway in downtown Santa Cruz, if you're interested. So check it out. Now I'm going to get back to a few interviews until, of course, I hear if any of you want to call in or talk about anything you've heard. I did get one call from another broadcaster who is actually also an indie media worker who has been putting up his own work on indiebay.org about migrant solidarity. That's Bradley. I encourage you to check out his stuff on the indiebay.org/Santa Cruz. That's the main story on the IndieBay page, Migrant Solidarity Prevails in Santa Cruz. That's about the anti-immigrant rally that fizzled at the town clock. Of course, what we need, of course, are rallies in front of growers and support for union activists and organizing. That's harder to do. It's easier to, of course, to stand up against misguided racist types who are simply interested in penalizing and scapegoating immigrants, and harder to actually change the working conditions. I don't know the way to do that. I'm not going to pretend I do. Author Schlosser talks about enforcing immigration law against growers who are, you know, perpetuating this cycle. And that's one thing to do. Of course, the immediate impact will be that the people are going to lose jobs immediately, and you're not going to make you too popular with the migrants who are losing the jobs that keep their families alive down in Oaxaca and Baja California and elsewhere. It's a real conundrum, but it's time to start working on it, and that's what the purpose of my playing this is. Also should point out that Eric Schlosser's book, Reefer Madness, is also very interesting around the issue of the marijuana industry, and I've played that part of it. That was what originally attracted my attention to this book, of this audio book. But the third part of it is equally interesting. It's about obscenity, or sex, and the sale of sexual products and pornography. And who knows, at some point, once if I ever get this tape again, I suspect it's going to go out to other folks, because I have had it too long. It will be, maybe I'll get into that at some point. Again, that's Schlosser, and the tape is Reefer Madness, Sex, Drugs, and Cheap Labor in the American Black Market. I'm sure the book is available. So let's go now to some more interviews on the street. And then after that, I think before I talked about the whole Santa Cruz City Council mess that happened on Tuesday, I'm going to make some comments about it. But I think most of my discussion of that issue is going to be reserved for Sunday, when I have a longer show that starts at 9:30 in the morning. And that will be where I'll play, I know, a lot of the city council discussion of the impeach Bush resolution, the peculiar behavior of the Rotkin majority on the city council when it voted to pass unanimously support for impeaching the Bush regime, but refused to put it on the ballot and allow the Santa Cruz community, the city citizens, to vote the same. Rotkin claimed he did this because he felt that the it would discourage people if they voted for it, and then the war or the if the Bush regime remained in power, as though it would just demoralize people, and it would seem merely symbolic, and it wouldn't have any impact, and it would then the other phrase, which didn't make much sense, it would distract from other items on the ballot. Actually, if you draw people to the election polls, they're likely to consider other items on the ballot because they're there anyway, and they're there for an item that they're concerned about. So it seemed a strange argument. And as I thought about it, I couldn't quite wrap my mind around it. And at first I assumed, well, Fitzmaurice has this resolution that the Code Pink people, activists in the Santa Cruz community who are opponents of Bush and opponents of the wars against Lebanon and against Iraq, are involved in. They asked Fitzmaurice to put a resolution on the ballot because I think something had also been done by the Berkeley City Council. The Berkeley City Council, without the benefit of thousands of signatures, had itself given the Berkeley voters an opportunity to vote on whether to impeach Bush. I believe that's it, although I haven't directly checked the internet on that. I think that's what was said at the council meeting. Someone could correct me if I'm wrong. And so Fitzmaurice, after hearing an eloquent plea from Sherry Conable and Louis LaFortune and many other people at the oral communications period 2 weeks ago at City Council, moved to put it on the agenda. And then suddenly a week ago, Rotkin slipped in with his own resolution, very similar to Fitzmaurice's, prior to that on the agenda, so it would come up first. And this was kind of orchestrated by Matthews, who's the mayor and arranges the agenda, and Vice Mayor Riley, who I understand at the end of the meeting was given credit for organizing this particular agenda. It's interesting, this, and I'm talking about it too much because I'm going to be talking about it on Sunday, but I will say that this agenda was, was an afternoon agenda with no evening agenda. Usually at the Santa Cruz City Council, you have a 3 o'clock agenda, and then you have a 7 o'clock agenda. And many people come to the 7 o'clock agenda because that's, you know, they aren't working during the day. It's time for activities in the evening. They aren't going to school and so forth. But Matthews orchestrated it so that this last council meeting of the summer, and there won't be another until the second Tuesday in September, was in the afternoon. And this had numerous implications. It meant she could... She claimed that she was short of time, and indeed she was. She made herself short of time. So she cut back people's time speaking. She crammed. She combined items. She used various devices that, in essence, cut back public comment time. Anyway, we're going to go into that on Sunday. But the one thing I want to say about the Rotkin maneuver which got the city council to pass 7-0 another impeach Bush resolution. It passed one previously 2 years ago, which actually said it was weakened. It didn't say impeach Bush. It said ask the House Judiciary Committee to investigate impeaching Bush. Weakened from other cities, and I was kind of annoyed at that one at the time. But again, the arguments you then Rotkin turned around and said, having passed this resolution, we don't want to put it on the ballot because, well, he didn't really suggest it would be too expensive. He initially said it would cost $5,000 to $20,000 to put, I don't know, four or five more lines on the ballot and then have ballot arguments for it. I guess it was Ed Porter who said he received one call against the resolution, and all the other calls were in favor of it. So he and two other people, Madrigal and Fitzmaurice, voted to put it on the ballot. But the four conservatives, Coonerty, Madrigal, Rotkin, and Matthews, voted not to put it on the ballot. And I couldn't understand it because Riley, who is a real turncoat in many ways, but prides herself in being this anti-war activist, why would she not give the voters the chance to vote? What she did was she turned around and used one of my arguments that I'd argued in my testimony that this was all, I didn't dismiss it. I said, put it on the ballot, but realize you need it more. You need to have the city council disinvest from any investments that are supporting military activities or arms activities in the Middle East with the U.S. government. And you never get the city council to even look into that. You need to have them pursuing what the human rights organizations Bob Patton and Bernard Klitzner have asked for, which is a war resisters zone. So we don't find ourselves and our local police handing over women who are abused in the military to military police, as happened in Portland, Oregon, or conscientious objectors or people resisting the war crimes, the war criminal behavior of our government, which is sending more troops to Iraq, as you probably know, and keeping more troops in Baghdad. And then, of course, sending, you know, it's our US F-111s are bombing the hell out of Lebanon and murdering civilians there. I mean, we don't want to be a part of this. We have to disinvest from it. We have to declare ourselves a war criminal free zone. We have to do a number of things. I was saying we should do that locally as well as urge that the House impeach Bush and that the Senate convict him. Riley turned that around to say, well, I agree with Mr. Norris. It would just be symbolic, and therefore we aren't going to put it on the ballot. And I couldn't figure out what the hell they were doing. I thought, you know, are they? I asked Mike Rotkin afterward. I said, you know, what is it, Mike? He said, oh, it just wouldn't have any meaning, and it would discourage people because they'd feel that they voted for it, and then nothing happened. That one just, as Mike Rotkin himself would say, doesn't pass the straight face test. It doesn't really. I talked to Louis LaFortune about it. Louis and I couldn't figure it out either. And then I had a serious thought the next morning at the teeny tiny Huff meeting as I was sitting there chatting with Becky Johnson. And I had the thought, which is actually Becky, I guess, kind of agreed with me because she put out the same thing on the Huff email list. Huff is Homeless United for Friendship and Freedom. And that thought was, why didn't I see this? Mike Rotkin and Cynthia Matthews are running for re-election. Do they want a bunch of leftists coming to vote on the November ballot who might also vote for other city council candidates that didn't criminalize the downtown, that didn't for street performers and poor people, that didn't increase the police department budget and destroy the Citizens Police Review Board, that didn't give the Parks and Rec Czarina Danette Shoemaker the power to close any park and rec area patrolled area at night, including the City Hall grounds, without even going to the Parks and Rec Commission? Mike Rotkin, who supported the Coast Santa Cruz Hotel development, over the design and was happy to destroy rent control at Clearview Court and at the De Anza Seniors Home. I think a lot of people would have been drawn to the election, to the ballot, with this impeach Bush resolution, who would then vote against Rotkin and Matthews. And that's the reason that they led the charge. Actually, Matthews said nothing, but Rotkin led the charge against this. And I'm hoping that this thing will boomerang on him, because what he's doing is he's telling the community of Santa Cruz they will not be allowed to vote on this issue. As symbolic as it may be, it'll have an impact in other cities. We have a caller. Hi, you're on Free Radio.
Hey, I was at that city council meeting, too.
Uh-huh.
And something that was suggested to me why they may have gone for that, for not letting the people vote, is because along with all those reasons that you said, perhaps they didn't want people to go out to vote for the 9.25 minimum wage.
Yeah.
That's coming up.
And of course, the medical marijuana initiative, which will...
Well, that's not even medical marijuana. That's just marijuana.
Right, you are. The tax and regulate marijuana for recreational marijuana.
People are going to be going to vote for that. The city council didn't just make that a law like they could have.
Right. So I think that you got a good point there that they don't want, but again, they do want people to vote for this. These two city council sponsored initiatives that passed. One is to raise the sales tax a quarter cent, and the other is to stop UC growth or to penalize UC growth.
Well, those people are going to come out to vote anyways, kind of. I mean, not those people. That's kind of
maybe
generic,
right, yeah.
But in general, to generalize,
uh-huh.
You know, a lot of the people that would come out to impeach Bush, you know, are probably going to also vote to give people a minimum wage raise, whereas people that are concerned with, like, UC expansion are going to be more like people that have been living here for a while.
And they keep a closer eye on elections,
yeah,
and so forth.
And they don't necessarily care about the 9.25.
Right. I mean, it seems, you know, I mean, but your point is well taken, although it is also true that these resolutions that are on the initiatives that are on the ballot, the minimum wage and the tax and regulate marijuana, are going to draw people anyway. So maybe, you know, Rodkin and Matthews are in some sense cutting their own throat by, you know, denying people the right to vote on the Bush thing.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know why they wouldn't just, if they were so anti-war as they say they are, I don't know why they wouldn't just let people express their vote too. I mean, the city council's already passed a bunch of resolutions, and, like, you know,
yeah,
you might as well try something new and letting people vote on it. You know, I'm not the biggest fan of voting in democracy. I think it's a sham, but whatever, you know, at least let people try it and express themselves that way. To say that it's, like, a waste of time and resources for the city, it seems like a crock of shit.
It seemed pretty weak, you know, pretty weak. And I guess I had the other thought, and this is why I talked to Louis about this afterward. I said, maybe Rodkin is saying, because Coonerty said this at the council meeting. You remember Coonerty said they can go out and get 7,000 signatures just like the tax and regulate people. Why don't they go do that?
Right, to elect a bunch of Democrats.
Right, and they also said that you can also go out and get signatures, you know, and thereby you'll prove the validity of what you're doing, and you can also go spend your time electing Democratic candidates elsewhere. That's a better and more effective way to, you know, to make sure there's a real impeachment rather than passing a symbolic resolution. And in a certain sense, I'm sure that's true, part of it. You know, if you get more Democrats elected, although they're a bunch of weak-kneed assholes, frankly, and you know, they don't mind the hell being bombed out of Lebanon. They're happy as pigs in a trough with that kind of stuff. But, you know, the fact of the matter, and they don't seem too concerned about withdrawing from Iraq either, and you, as everybody knows. But it is true that if you have more Democrats in power, they're more likely to take some moves against Bush. So I say, sure, go out and vote whoever in close races, Green or Democrat, is likely to beat the Republicans. You know, that's in a certain sense, although I'm very cynical of supporting Democrats under any circumstances. But this doesn't have much to do with this particular tax, this particular impeach Bush resolution, allowing the people to vote on it. In fact, letting people vote on it would mobilize people to do more. It might even encourage people to do the kind of thing that Rodkin is, and that Coonerty and I guess other people were talking about, who thought, you know, that it would be good to get out there and do other things than simply put a resolution on the ballot.
I agree. Yeah. All right. Well, thanks for letting me voice.
Sure.
All right. Bye.
Thank you. Phone line's open, 427-3772. You can call in. Again, I'm going to be taking up this subject at greater length on Sunday when I'll be playing. I guess you should all stay asleep for this one. It's kind of a snoozer in a way. The city council oral communications discussion and the actual council debate on the issue, because I'm really kind of talking about the meat of my concerns right now. I don't know if I need to actually play all that stuff, and it's available if you want to get it. It'll be in the library, and it'll probably be replayed on channel 27 or channel 25 if you have TV, cable TV. But I may play it anyway, because I think people took the time to come to city council to talk about it, and they got out on the air. Maybe I should talk about it too. And some of those people, to their credit, stayed to talk about the local issue of giving the head of Parks and Rec the power without any kind of check to close down any area in the city that she wants to that's patrolled by Parks and Rec, including City Hall, including parts of Pacific Avenue, including all kinds of areas that it just made no sense other than just increasing police power, which, you know, you'd think that the city would be going in the different direction than the national and state government. Of course, they're not. They're all part of the same, fortunately, it's part of the same mentality, it looks like. Unanimously, including Tony Madrigal, the great, you know, the liberal that we love so much, the great, you know, friend of the immigrants and all that stuff. So, again, that'll be happening on Sunday. Tune in at 9:30 for more of that. Now here's some more street interviews, and I hope we'll have time for the Public Safety Committee's discussions on Monday, which I caught only a part, but we'll see if we get there. Stay tuned.
It's about 8:20 out here at Pacific Avenue Sunday evening. The sun is just setting or set. Lots of people on the streets. The heat is dying down, but CJ, wouldn't call him hot under the collar, but I wouldn't call him happy either. What's happening, CJ?
I played my butt off today, and I ain't made nothing. I made eating money. It's just like everybody's all of a sudden stopped tipping. And, you know, if I was anybody else, I would question whether I'm doing a good job. But I'll always sit down and I play music, and I do it honestly. And this town has stopped appreciating it. It's really weird.
So it's not just this Sunday. You think it's previous Sundays as well? Or?
Oh, yeah. During the week, I'm lucky. I sit up 2 hours, and I'm lucky to make eating money. I mean, we're talking like Taco Bell, you know? And I don't know what's going on. I really don't. It's just, I think it's the economy, the gas prices or something. But Santa Cruz used to appreciate their art forms, whether it be painting, whatever.
Nice.
It's not happening now.
Well, is this going to cut into your plan to file a large lawsuit if they attempt to move you from the eaves of the parking garage under the 15-minute parking garage paranoia law when it goes into effect?
Well, I've advised my lawyer. I told him this is possibly going to happen. And he's setting a precedence, probably, maybe. Oh, my God, there goes the neighborhood.
And we'll leave CJ as he makes another associate. Any final comment?
My problem is we've got so many bad musicians out here now because of the laws that I don't even play out here anymore. I play across from clouds because I'm not hassled.
In an illegal location, I might note.
Not yet. They don't have the signs up.
That's true. Actually, in theory, it is illegal now, but they're not enforcing.
Mm-hmm.
Oh,
pass me by. They ain't hassling me yet.
Let's hope the city doesn't pass you by like it currently did today.
Could be.
Thank you, CJ. You know that poet on the street, Shannon. Shannon, you recently have been, should we say, gracing certain venues with your lyrical thoughts?
Yeah, I'm writing poetry. I've gotten deep. I don't know what to tell you.
Got any poetic lines for it?
I sit on the street and look at the tourists in their brand new expensive shoes, walk down the avenue, and I hear an old black man sing the blues about a cheeseburger or a burrito supreme.
Sounds like Santa Cruz to me. Thank you, Shannon. How's everything going on the streets? You're still out of doors?
Yeah, not for very much longer, though.
Still separated from your loved ones?
Yeah, not for very much longer, though.
And how else, any other, I guess your poetry is this report from the street, right?
Yeah, pretty much.
Wow. Well, you look healthier, although none of all that, hope we're not getting too speeded out here, Shannon. No comment. All right.
Do I look awake at all to you?
You look a little sleepy. Have you been sleeping illegally again in public?
No, I don't. That's why I'm tired.
All right.
I need chocolate.
See you later, Shannon. We're talking to a man who just got out of a 5-year stint at
Quentin and Vacaville.
Your name, sir?
Tim.
And, Jim, you were previously a Santa Cruz habitué?
Yes.
Your crime was possession and use of cocaine?
Yes.
Any violence attached?
No.
And did you suffer any violence in prison?
Yes.
Anything you want to talk about?
Sure.
I've heard, of course, massive overcrowding in the prisons, miserable medical treatment, racism to the max. What's the story in these two prisons?
Well, what I went through is basically I was medical and mental health. I was medical and mental health. And they keep all the mental health in one area, and they attack each other. And twice I was attacked and almost stabbed. It got to the point where I just stayed in my cell for like 3 years of my time. I stopped going to the yard. I stopped going to the cafeteria because that's most of the places where you get attacked. And
how could you get your meals if you didn't go to the cafeteria?
Well, my family was sending me money, and they have what they call a canteen, a store. And you order so much food, you spend like $200 in the store. So basically, I was eating Top Ramen for 3 years and, you know, Vienna sausages and sardines.
And again, which prison was this?
That one was Vacaville, where I did 4 years. I went to Quentin, and I did a year first, though. Vacaville is medical because I'm medical and psych.
So what is your medical condition?
I'm a victim of multiple gunshot wounds. I got shot 10 times.
By?
Two people in Little Rock, Arkansas.
They were on a shooting expedition, or what was the deal?
I met a girl, and one of them was her boyfriend, and she didn't tell me she had a boyfriend.
Oh, it was a writ of jealous phage.
Right. It was two shooters with two Berettas.
Now, we last saw each other here in Santa Cruz. You got arrested here in Santa Cruz for all this cocaine shit?
Yeah, at the Peter Pan Hotel.
And was this some federal, state, slash local task force? Or?
No, just regular Santa Cruz PD. Mm-hmm. Somebody called them, and they showed up about 3 o'clock in the morning.
Now, you're an African-American.
Yes, and Italian-American.
And Italian-American.
Yes.
You speak Italian by chance?
Nah, not much. Dammi il mano. Scappe.
And no connections with the mob in the joint?
No, none of my family into that.
But so you were captured, tried here in Santa Cruz and convicted. Did you do a deal or did you go to trial?
I did a deal. I was kind of fearful. See, where I come from in San Francisco, I probably would have never got convicted of this charge. You know, there was no violence based around it. And at the time, Terrence Hellerman was the district attorney there.
Up in San Francisco. Tell him,
He wasn't prosecuting drug cases at that time. Now the new woman is in there. She's vigorously prosecuting drug cases.
So was it a case of sales, possession, both?
Use.
5 years for use?
Yeah.
First offense?
I had a prior robbery from the 80s, and they did a two-strike double enhancement. See, we had a strike law before three strikes ever came.
Wow. So now you're back in Santa Cruz, and you've got some commentary about the shelter system?
Yeah, I've seen that it's stagnated for men and women, single men and women. Mm-hmm. I guess Ken Cole found out that he could get money for families. Well, they got that new building over there. They can't fill it up, but there's still more men and women. In fact, since I've been there, they stopped the couples group, and they spend a lot of money at the Armory every year. Make me understand why all them bays they got there, they can't make a single woman and single man shelter right there on the property.
At the actual site of the Homeless Service Center.
Right.
115
why
Coral.
Why are they paying them thousands of dollars at the National Guard Armory that they're only using 3 months out the year?
Well, they don't want to offend the neighbors, do they?
Well, the people are hanging around anyway. They're camping out all around the neighbors. During the day, they're walking around. They're outside around the neighbors more than they're in the shelter because you have to leave the shelter at 10 o'clock in the morning now and not come back until 12. Anyway.
No loitering at the shelter?
No loitering at the shelter.
What if you want to do mail or laundry?
If you want to do mail or are you going on the laundry list or are you going to the health clinic, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But it used to be you could go in there and sit and watch TV. You should go upstairs. You could lay down and go to sleep during the day. They stop all of that.
They're trying to train you to stop sleeping at night because, you see, you're not supposed to, as you know, sleep at night under the sleeping ban. So in order to learn that properly, you got to stop sleeping during the day, too.
Well, see, what happens? What do they want you to do? Walk around town all night? Or do like this? See, I'm disabled. I can't get up in the jungle to poke a nip. You know, I got 3 bullets on my spine. You know what I'm saying?
How long you been back in town?
I've been back in town. Well, I just became re-homeless 13 days ago.
Because?
I was kicked out of the hotel that I was in.
Not for cocaine use.
No, playing loud music.
Playing loud music.
Yeah. Interesting enough, the manager that kicked me out, I got 2 calls from the hotel. They found her dead in her room Friday.
This wasn't connected with the eviction, we hope.
No way. I've been in Santa Cruz. That's in Watsonville.
Huh.
No way. I'm not involved in nothing like that.
No, I wouldn't say you were. So I've got my eye on you.
Okay. Keep watching me. I'll be here every day.
Now, you've been out on the street for 13 days and 13 nights?
Yes.
Where do you, what kind of, can you please tell the police department where you're sleeping so they can come and help you out?
I ain't going to do that. I got a parole officer, too. He's trying to find out.
Well, be in contact with him as soon as possible. Would you like to give your name?
Tim.
Thank you, Tim.
And that was an interview on Pacific Avenue from a few days ago. You're tuned to Free Radio, 101.1 FM, freakradio.org. Call the station if you'd like, 831-427-3772, 427-3772. Call Free Radio Santa Cruz if you'd like, if you want to be involved with the station, you want more information, you want to contribute something, you want to be perhaps a programmer yourself, it's 427-4523, 427-4523. Download an application at freakradio.org. So, we've got about half an hour. I think we may be able to get some of this in. This is the Public Safety Committee, or so they call themselves, which is Rotkin, Coonerty, and Porter, 3 city council members, one of whom is running for re-election, who claim to oversee the police department. You may remember way back when there was a half 6 months ago, public document requests uncovered a scandal. Actually, it was more than that. It was just undercover officers being recognized by Rico Thunder and others at their meeting of the last night, planning for last night parade, the peaceful First Amendment parade that came off very successfully. But, of course, exposed the fact that the police department, if it doesn't regularly have, at least on this one occasion, did some investigating and researching and surveilling and snooping and record-keeping and perhaps record-sharing, we don't know, on peaceful protesters. What were the guidelines? There were no guidelines. And rather than give the whole history of this, we will kind of come up to the present very quickly by saying the history is covered on indiebay.org. I suggest you go there. I've written about it, so has Rico Thunder and others very effectively. This is a committee meeting that is supposed to be the public comment section on the new police guidelines, even though the police guidelines have been declared unilaterally enforced by Mayor Matthews, without any kind of city council vote, without any kind of public discussion. And this isn't really a public discussion. It's a little bit of input that the Public Safety Committee is allowing. Now, I asked the Public Safety Committee to record its own meeting so there will be a tape available for the public. It refused, even though I requested in advance. I was also curious that they were holding their initially scheduled meeting at 4 o'clock in the afternoon on Monday of this week earlier. Bad time for people generally. And then they moved it to 3:30. So that the people who thought it was at 4 o'clock didn't know about that either. And there are only 4 of us in the room. There was a couple people from the Human Rights Organization, Bernard Klitzner and Bob Patton and myself and the inevitable Michael Tomasi. So, unfortunately, the first half of my tape failed. The pause button was on, some problem with the machine. So there is no record of the first half of this meeting other than some sketchy notes and perhaps some minutes that were taken by the staffer, who I don't much like. Her name is Tina Scholl, but she has tried to be of assistance in the past, and I guess my attitude towards her isn't really relevant. So let's Let's hear some of this, and I will pause to comment. I hope it's audible. It's kind of it's a tape, again, from a small handheld tape recorder placed on the dais of the City Council Public Safety Committee. By this time, more people had filtered in, including two reporters from the one from the Mercury News, one from the Sentinel. Tony Madrigal, council member, had come in. An attorney from the ACLU, Don Zimmerman, and another attorney from the Northern California ACLU was there. And again, we had the three council members, Coonerty, Rotkin, and Porter, doing the duck and cover routine where they essentially didn't really put into the guidelines any number of things that the ACLU and other activists wanted. Rico Thunder had sent a letter to the Public Safety Committee stating that he wasn't coming because he saw that they were not serious and it was time. He was essentially wasting his time. It's on Indie Bay called Activist Disengage from the Santa Cruz Police. And I may read that letter later if I have time, but I'm going to play some of the tape now so you can hear what little documentary record exists of the City Council's endless duck and cover committee process. This is the committee that replaces, to some extent, or not at all really, but that now covers the police department after the Rotkin Matthews Council killed the Citizens Police Review Board back in 2003 in January.
Against its officers if that information is in a form which does not identify the individuals involved. So,
and we're listening now to Don Zimmerman of the local ACLU, who we pick it up from the middle because the previous recording wasn't recording. He's talking about problems he sees in the current police guidelines that were unilaterally declared 3 weeks before by Matthews, essentially coming from Howard Scarry, the police chief's earlier guidelines, which were also unilaterally declared, I think, the day after the deputy chief announced his investigation was over, that he had investigated himself, found he was okay, so was the police chief, he was okay, so with that, so was the city manager, so was the mayor, but whoops, suddenly the police auditor said, you know, you can't really investigate yourself, so let's hold up on that. And then suddenly they all quickly turn around, oh, yes, we want another investigation. But, of course, they held no public hearings on this at all during the four-month period where they met behind closed doors and cooked up the current guidelines, which are now being criticized here by Don Zimmerman.
Something ought to be able to be worked out that is a bit more accommodating to accountability to the public and principles of transparency than we have at the present time. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Well, thank you all for coming, particularly Mr. Schlossberg, who came in a great distance to be here, and Mr. Anderson. Although paid by the city, still had to come a great distance here to join us.
Councilmember
Rotkin. I just want to be brief in summing up my remarks about this. But,
and I believe, hang on, it's either Coonerty or Schlosserman. Hang on.
Things that we should remember when we're looking at this. One is that when we went looking for a model policy.
Yes, this is Councilmember Coonerty, the only lawyer on the City Council, except, of course, for City Attorney John Barisoni, who runs the City Council. He and City Attorney Dick Wilson are they exercise disproportionate influence on the City Council. This is Coonerty is the guy who is so constitutionally law oriented that he couldn't find any meaningful restrictions on constitutional rights in the parking garage paranoia law, the 15-minute trespass law that says you can no longer read a book in your car after you paid your money to park your vehicle, but have to leave within 15 minutes because you might be a public safety hazard. And his response to that was, oh, well, you see, parking garages are not public forums. Try and figure that one out. You can take your constitution and chew on that for a while. Anyway, this is Coonerty talking about how wonderful the guidelines are because the Santa Cruz City has these guidelines. It's more puff piece, of course, for the city, but let him speak for himself.
So we're talking about whether Santa Cruz is 95% better or 98% better than other cities in the United States. And so there is room for improvement, and I appreciate Mr. Schlossberg coming down, and I think that the discussion needs to continue. But we should keep in perspective that we're talking about a very small percentage in terms of Santa Cruz is in a very...
What Kennedy is talking about here is he's saying other police departments don't have surveillance guidelines, so isn't Santa Cruz wonderful because it has guidelines? And the answer is that there are numerous cities in California that do, including San Francisco, Sacramento, Los Angeles, Modesto. This according to Mark Schlossberg, who I later interviewed, and we may be able to hear that interview, if not today, then on Sunday. He's trying to make it appear like it's picayune to criticize, and gosh, you know, here's some these concerns, we'll consider them. In fact, these concerns were presented because Schlossberg was a part of this, was supposed to be a part of the process of creating these guidelines, these checks on the police department to make sure the citizenry does not have its constitutional rights violated by cops gathering notes on you and the organizations you join and the marches you decide to be a part of. And instead of considering the concerns, the city manager unilaterally declared with the police chief and the mayor that they were just going to ignore them and didn't give any reasons why. And Coonerty had no problem with that. He's fine. He's saying, well, you know, I'm glad he came down here to discuss his reasons. But, of course, Schlossberg had already presented his reasons in writing 2 months before. And his committee, the Public Safety Committee, which had some input in this process, which I'm sure was being advised along the way as to what was going on, had no concerns that basic civil liberties concerns, as expressed by the ACLU, indeed, this very individual from the ACLU whose Public Records Act requests had revealed and exposed all this police misconduct, were being completely ignored. And you can actually read Schlossberg's letter on this issue. It's online again on Indie Bay under, it's a horrible police or a horrible search engine that is not particularly effective on Indie Bay, or at least I can't fathom it. Maybe we can get some Indie Bay person calling in and talking about it. It's under the story Last Rights Parade and Protest, and you can find the June 27th letter by Mark Schlossberg of the ACLU to the police department, in which he expresses six different concerns about these guidelines, which include the fact that the police, they don't specify what First Amendment activities are, so that they're saying we're going to protect First Amendment activities, but they don't say what that is. There's a number of other concerns, including it only covers undercover investigations, so they can still compile records on you. They can still go investigate your organization, pass on information about your organization to other police departments using public money if they do so without undercover operations. So it doesn't stop the chilling of First Amendment activity. It also, and it, they will allow you to investigate undercover or otherwise any First Amendment activities if there is, if they feel that there'll be some kind of criminal, potential or technical criminal violation. Now in San Francisco, it has to be more than possible property damage or more than $2,500. Otherwise, you can't use that as an excuse to send an undercover officer into the group. But there's no such restriction on the SCARY guidelines. That's Chief Scary's SCARY guidelines in Santa Cruz. I should say the Wilson, Barisone, Rotkin, Matthews guidelines, because those are the people in our community, the mayor, the vice mayor, city attorney, and the city manager, not in that order. Also, the police chief himself is not required to okay First Amendment protected investigations of First Amendment protected activity, but the deputy chief, that's the same guy, Vogel, who did this, who authorized this bad investigation and undercover operation, and then investigated himself, throwing two rounds of bad judgment. It's like the police department is just thumbing its nose at the community and saying, see, not only can we fuck up twice, but we can do it the third time, we can do it again, because we're not even going to require Chief Scary to take responsibility. We'll leave it in the hands of Deputy Chief Vogel, the guy who made the mistake in the first place. Nor is there any policy or any language in the new policy that would stop police officers from working on multi-agency task forces that say want them to investigate, and they can't. The police officers can't say, wait a minute, our Santa Cruz police guidelines prohibit this. Instead, they will just jump on board and investigate whatever the feds and the states want them to do. And then there's no auditing section where there has to be a public disclosure of surveillance afterward. to those organizations that have been improperly surveilled. There's no such requirement. And then the most important thing of all is that none of this is an ordinance. It's all just a policy, which the police chief can change at will, and which there's no kind of check and requirement that he be held accountable for this, other than his goodwill, or the fact that the city manager, his friend of goodness knows how many years, may fire him if he fucks up too badly. Not likely, considering what we've seen in the last 6 months. Or even worse, stuff that we haven't seen because it didn't come to light. So those are the things that the ACLU recommended, and that Coonerty, our constitutional protector, the man who guards the Santa Cruz, the rights of all of us, and actually just guards the police department, he's defending this policy. It's policy 610. It's also online. If you want to look at it again, you go to indiebay.org and you look for the story, Last Rights Parade and Protest. And it's right there about four or five stories down in the main story section on the page. So check that out. Continuing with the Police Public Safety Committee's hearing and discussion, and it's interesting to hear.
Having a policy like this, and that's important to remember. The second thing is that I do believe that just because we don't have a policy doesn't mean that First Amendment protections don't exist. You have vibrant First Amendment federal case law, and you have even stronger state case law, and that provides protections. It's not as though because there is an absence of a departmental directive, there's no First Amendment rights in Santa Cruz.
Try to make some sense of this, folks. This is Coonerty, the lawyer, the city council member, saying, we don't need a law protecting us. We don't need a policy to protect us, because somewhere in the case law, the officers will know that it's not right to go after peaceful political protesters who are just planning to do a march down to Pacific Avenue. Well, apparently it didn't work last time. I don't know why Coonerty thinks it's going to work next time.
Last thing is, I do think that there is a value from the fact that this came from the police department. I think that it adds legitimacy in the eyes of the police officers when they're talking about abiding by the rules they've set forward.
Now, this is really very key, because it really gives you the basis for what's going on here. He's looking completely from the perspective of the police department. And indeed, earlier, some months ago, Coonerty expressed his concern that the rights of police officers not be violated, as though he were some sort of defense lawyer for the police department, instead of supposedly being our representative on the city council. What he's saying here is that because this doesn't offend the police, because it comes from the police department, so it doesn't defend the police department, it's a better policy than it comes from, let's say, an independent body, the ACLU, the city council, because that might, you know, make the police department cranky. It might make them feel they're being oppressed or pressed to do something in some way that they don't want to do. And interestingly enough, Bob Aronson, who's the police auditor, I should say the independent auditor of the police department, who the community, some people in the community gave high marks because he said the report is a bad report when it came out in February or March that investigated the whole thing, because the investigator was the very guy who authorized it, Deputy Chief Vogel, the very guy who authorized the snooping in the first place, went and investigated. Everybody said, Bob Aronson, our savior, and so forth. But Bob Aronson also said in this hearing and afterward that he felt it was much better to have these informal arrangements with the police department, because they're more likely to be effective than having to go to court and so forth. And Aronson's opinion is not to be dismissed completely out of hand, because here's a guy who makes money, not just $20,000 by kind of draining the blood of the corpse of the Citizens Police Review Board here. He took over their job once they were killed by the city council. But he also garners funds from L.A. and other jurisdictions as a police auditor, and he parades around the state as a police auditor at these different conventions and so forth. And, you know, he expresses a great interest in controlling improper police behavior. And I suppose in a certain sense, if you can get the police department on board, that's a good thing, sure. But you have to first establish the standards that you want them to use to get them on board and make sure that you're not surrendering that whole debate and discussion to them in the first place. So for Coonerty to say that it's really a good thing that these things came from the police department, to me, rings the wrong note entirely. It means that, you know, we are allowing the very people who abuse the public trust in the first place to write the laws. Not even the laws, the policy.
That it's not something that's being forced upon them, but it's something that they adopted after consulting with members of the ACLU and other groups. I think the council could come forward with a number of ordinances, but in terms of how they are effective in the real world, I think it matters that the police, this is a directive that came from the police. When shoe leather hits the street or whatever the phrase is, that it matters.
Not putting aside the great articulation skills of Coonerty, which aren't really relevant, I also want to point out that you can now hear Coonerty, kind of. I mean, it's not a very good tape, but you can hear him. The first part of this tape, which I don't have because it wasn't taping at the time, but I was playing it in hopes it would tape, Mike Rotkin refused to ask that the microphones be turned on so that people could actually hear what was going on. I mean, I asked that the sound system be turned on. It was only halfway through the hearing when Bernard Klistner shouted, "We need to be able to hear it," and there were more people in the audience, that Rotkin finally agreed to turn on the sound system at the City Hall so that people could hear it. So again, we're talking about four different things. Rotkin refuses to turn on the sound system. Rotkin refuses to record the meeting. Rotkin schedules the meeting for an afternoon time instead of the evening time when people can't come, and Rotkin moves the time from 4 o'clock back to 3:30 so the people who had previously planned to come, and there were about 7 or 8 of them, get there halfway through the meeting. I want to say, full disclosure, there was a meeting at the police department around public safety issues, around shootings and stabbings, and there's going to be some kind of a march on Saturday, one coming from Barrios Unidos and one coming from the Beach Flats, converging on City Hall, on the town clock at noon against violence organized by the police department and other community groups. And while I'm all against violence, I want to say, marches organized by the police department make me very, very nervous on these issues. I think we should keep an eye out for each other. I don't think we should try to stop violence where we see it. But the most organized violence in this community comes from the Santa Cruz Police Department, the deputy sheriffs, and those people who are regularly using tasers and killing people with them. Consider how many people are killed with tasers by police officers and how many people are killed with tasers by non-police officers. Haven't heard of anybody killed by a taser by a non-police officer. However, I know of David Anthony Cross, whose corpse is dead and buried because he was killed by a sergeant under the leadership of Sergeant Robbins, Sheriff Robbins, in the jail. When there were five or six other police officers around and other alternatives, instead they tasered this guy to death. You may remember David Anthony Cross last fall. More from the Public Safety Committee. And again, I'm going to run out of time, so I'll be playing more of this tape on Sunday at 9:30 in the morning when I come back. You're invited to join me then, and I encourage you to kind of do some reading. Read the Last Rights Parade and Protest articles on indiebay.org/Santa Cruz, even if you don't like their prior censorship policy of Becky Johnson, which has changed, at least on homeless issues, as I understand it. I've talked about that a lot on the air, so I want to clarify that. Do read this stuff. A lot of good articles, a lot of good writing, useful stuff to know, and important background. And in a way, it's a tempest in a teapot, as some say, the surveillance stuff. There's more important stuff, use of force, tasering deaths, lack of accountability generally by the police department. But this opens the door so you can see the whole murky process a little more clearly and how corrupt the whole situation is. And remember, you do have a vote in this coming election if enough candidates run. And I encourage people to consider running for city council, if only to speak in the forums against people like Rotkin and Matthews and what they're doing, and to expose issues that need to be exposed. You can run for city council if you're a resident of Santa Cruz. You have to be a resident, meaning you have to have a Santa Cruz address within the city limits. You can, some addresses are outside. Anyway, I think we're going to play a little more, and then I'm going to call it an evening. I do have in the studio with me a guest. Are you a guest, or are you just a sort of a sitter-by there?
I don't know. I don't know what I am right now.
This is the, of course, infamous Craig Canada, who can be found online arguing about medical marijuana and the right to for poor people to be able to use it without being evicted from their housing. He's had his difficulties with the Homeless Services Center. You finally got your stuff from the locker there?
Yeah, a couple of weeks ago I went through it, and looks like everything was there. There was some antibiotics that were missing, about $150 worth, but I didn't go through everything, so...
You know, I didn't really care about the antibiotics, so I don't know if they were missing or not. But, yeah, I did get my stuff back. Someone actually did it for me and actually went to a great deal of trouble. I think it took 22 phone calls. It took 12 phone calls to get someone to call to get through to somebody. And now that you got me talking about it, you know, I was banned from homeless services. And prior to that, Marcus had told me, I can't remember his last name right now, Banuelos or something like that. But he had told me that, you know, if I had any problems, to give him a call instead of yelling at people or yelling for help or yelling for them to leave me alone. And, so if I'm on the lot and I have a problem, I'm supposed to call, I guess, over a week's time, 12 different times. I thought about that.
So you got your stuff, but you're still banned from the Homeless Services Center.
I suppose if I could have, I believe they wanted an apology from me for expressing my contempt for someone or for the whole situation. And the fact was that person slammed a locker into my head, never apologized to me, never received any sanctions as far as I know, locker door into my head.
But there were some complaints about your spitting on the guy the next time you saw him, and would you be willing to engage in some kind of mediation as far as anger management went if they would have some way of controlling his behavior or sanctioning him? I mean, would you be willing to go halfway on that?
Anger management?
I'm thinking, I don't know. I don't know what the deal was. I mean, you were pissed, right? And you spat in his face.
Yeah, it's been a long series of harassment from him. Basically, for the last, I don't know how many months, every time I've gone to my locker, he's essentially been harassing me. He seems to be there all the time in the middle of the day, and as I said, he slammed his locker door into my head once.
Now, wait a minute. You're not allowed to loiter or linger at the Homeless Services Center in the middle of the day. How can you suggest he might be there?
He was. I guess he needed to use his locker, and you know, now that I think of it, maybe that was what this was all about, is the only reason he could be there was that he was claiming to use his locker, so he had to use his locker every 5 minutes in order to stay there.
He was actually in the way of you using your locker, because you had to get past him or he had to get past you or something.
Well,
like that.
I didn't have any problem with him using his locker while I was using mine. The fact was that when this happened, I was in my locker looking for a ticket, which my mother ended up paying, for sitting on the riverbank. I don't understand why he couldn't use his locker, and I don't understand why the lot manager had to come and tell me that I had to stop going through my locker so he could use his. I really don't understand any of that. I don't understand why he couldn't use his locker.
Well, whatever the situation, another question that's come up at the Huff meeting is about an appeal process for all this. I mean, in case you do, for whatever reason, want to go back there because you want to meet someone there, you want to talk to someone, you want to get access to a different locker or have a meal there, do you want the right to be able to go in there? Is that of interest to you?
No, it isn't. And, you know, if I would be interested, if that's the only... no, I'm not. I'm not interested in going back there. I have been in that place since April a year ago. I've been a year and a half. I spent 6 months there in the church groups, you know, and they seemed to have no problem with me. Actually, until I bought my computer just before Thanksgiving, I spent another 6 months going there to shower and use the locker and trying to talk to those people. And I really don't want to deal with them anymore. My opinion is that they come from this recovery AA mentality, either that or they're just going by the government rule book. But the whole problem is that I'm a medical marijuana patient, and they don't recognize it. They don't recognize it as medicine. They consider me a drug addict, and that's the problem.
Well, we got 2 minutes to the end of my show, and, of course, the bombs are falling. U.S. armaments rushed to the Israeli government in Lebanon, and, of course, very little was said about that at the city council. Instead of this sort of ancient, warmed-over resolution about Bush, which I've been talking about at great length, impeaching Bush, we, of course, needed some immediate demand that there be a ceasefire, a cessation of hostilities, cessation of U.S. support for this latest aggression in southern Lebanon. And that, of course, didn't merit virtually any attention by anybody, even in the audience, much less city council. Even I said nothing about it. I think I may have made a couple of distant references. So I didn't talk about it on this show either. I mean, you can get, of course, endless talk about it on Amy Goodman and other places about, you know, UN observers getting the shit blown out of them, four of them blown away, and 10 different phone calls to the Israeli army resulting in simply more death. And no stopping of the bombing of the UN observation post. I mean, you know, it's hard to tell who's telling the truth, but the stories don't look good and the general figures look horrible. And what can Santa Cruz do? Well, it's always a question I have about these issues insofar as we're contributing or not contributing to this. I thank you for being with me on this edition of Bathroom Spears Broadsides. Critics or supporters of the Israeli government who may want to call in and talk about this issue will have an opportunity to do so on Sunday, briefly, depending on whether I go on at great length about this and whether we're all still around on Sunday, which I hope we will be. You can reach me off air at 423-HUFF, 423-4833. And I can also encourage you to go to the Can't Stop the Clock play that's happening right now, 8 o'clock, at the Broadway Playhouse, 526 Broadway. And again, it'll be happening on Saturday night at 8 o'clock. So check that out. Then you want to go to the actual clock and watch the police parade as they all parade in against violence. Maybe have a sign or two against police violence. You can do that, too, at noon on Saturday. So check it out. Here's a little Ann Feeney to end the hour.
One, two. She told me the state is my enemy. The lady on the left saying property is theft. A year in the slammer couldn't keep her mouth shut. J. Edgar Hoover couldn't move her from my heart. I'm talking Emma. Emma, Emma Goldmine, Emma.
mean, two people who want to commit to a stable, monogamous, lifelong relationship. What are they, nuts? It's unnatural. Oh, a man must never lie with a person who is a guy. He should only lie to his wife. The Bible is clear. We're defenders of marriage in three-button suits. We'll raise our double standard and see who salutes. Defenders of marriage, defending the institution from people who want to get married. Now, every time we think about same-sex parents, oh my gosh, we exclaim. I mean, to people who want to provide a protective and nurturing family environment, have they no shame? It's so deviant. It's the Lord's holy word, as my second wife said to my third, that a family's based on obligation and fear. We're defenders of marriage, connubial narcs, ever vigilant patriotic patriarchs. Defenders of marriage, defending the institution from people who want to get married. Turn gay to annoy Dick Cheney and Dick Army. We're an army of dicks with a militant stance, getting the government off our backs and into our pants. Defenders of marriage, defending the institution from people who want to get married, have their insurance carried, be beneficiaries, and be with the ones they love when they are buried. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. Oh, my feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. 1955, that's a lifetime ago. Remember I Like Ike, remember Jim Crow. Montgomery, Alabama, sleepy southern town. That woman started something when she sat down. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. Hundreds walk to work in the morning light. Thousands walking home from their jobs at night. The days turn to weeks, the weeks turn to months. It was more. My feet are tired. My feet are tired, but my soul is rested. Working back then, you would hear people say, I only want my kids to see a better day. I thought it over and I've changed my mind. I want to see freedom. My feet are tired. Oh, my feet are tired, but my soul is rested. My feet are tired. My feet are tired.
You're